Welcome to A Quiet Life. I'm your host, Ruth Amos. 1 Thessalonians 4 says, make it your ambition to lead a quiet life. In this podcast, I chat to all sorts of normal Christians, asking them just how they live their quiet lives and how they integrate their faith into their daily lives. I hope that by listening, you will be encouraged to go out and live your own quiet life to the glory of God. You can find the episode show notes, the Quiet Life blog, and other resources at ruthamos.com.au. That's ruthamos.com.au. Now let's get on with the show. Hello, I'm Ruth, your host. It's great to have you here on A Quiet Life. Today is episode 49. I think I may have said 47 last week, but it was actually 48. And now today is 49. And as I record this, it is Wednesday, the 11th of December. And we're like full on into December now. And Christmas is just around the corner. And yes, anyway, more on that later. But today's guest is Sean Gaffney. Again, it's part two of, wouldn't you believe it, a three-part conversation, which, look, I've just been listening to, fixing up the transcription and listening to the conversation that we had again. And honestly, you really don't want to miss any of this story. It's just amazing. So today we talk about, let me just go to the show notes and make sure I've got it right. We talk about faith and art and how important it is to show your faith in your art. We start with the story of how Sean became a writer and how he learned the skills of writing, how God just put him in a place where he could sit at the feet of somebody important and talented and skilled and learn the skills from him, and how he met his wife, which is a very lovely story, and I'm sure you'll enjoy that. He said to edit it out. I'm not going to. It's too good. And how he wrote a script for Big Idea, the VeggieTales people, and how that all worked, and how he started working for Warner Brothers. And so we go through all that, and then we go on to the time where everything went very wrong and it all fell apart. And we talk quite a bit about fear and failure. And so it's a great conversation, and I'm sure you will get a lot out of it. My personal life update. Well, I took an unexpected trip to Canberra last week to celebrate the life of a friend and to meet up with some friends and help them grieve. And it was very beautiful. And, you know, the timing was perfect for the visit. And it was lovely to catch up with people. And it was special to celebrate Laurie's life. And I'm grateful that I could go up there and do that. And it was a blessing. And I've just come back and today gone and celebrated the life of Ken as well. And so it's good to hear the stories of the lives of people who have lived full lives where they've given God the glory in what they've done. And Laurie really wanted to make sure that people knew about Jesus in his service, which was very cool. Ken was described as the absolute gentleman, quietly going about his business and getting it done, but always being calm and careful of people. And that was lovely as well. So yeah, it's been a bit of a week for it. And I'm continuing to celebrate Advent in my own little completely incorrect, wrong coloured candles way. But it's been meaningful for me and really helped me to stop and think about what Christmas is about. And I have written a bit of a blog post about that this week, which I encourage you to go ahead and read. And I've already actually got next week's blog post written because I had another story in my head that I wanted to tell. So you can look forward to that. So if you don't already read my blog, you can find it at aquietlifeblog.wordpress.com. And I would love to share it with you. So Moz has just gone off on a grade 9 camp, and I'm expecting Caleb to turn up at the door coming back from his car competition at any moment. So it's quite funny. We've got Christmas bits and pieces going on, Christmas block party at the end of the week, and all those kind of things happening. And in between all that, I'm trying to do my day job, which is editing, and I have an academic thesis which is about poultry litter or chicken poo, and I'm trying to spend as much time as possible with chicken poo so that I can get it done before Jess comes home for Christmas. So if you think of me at all over the next couple of weeks, you can see me busily with my head down, well up, looking at my computer screen and thinking about chicken poo, as you do. It's a fun thing. So anyway, that's me. That's my life at the moment. I know that you will enjoy the second part of the interview with Sean. It stops abruptly again, but as you'll be able to see, we haven't asked any of the normal questions. You know, when do you feel close to God and what's one thing you want everyone to know? And they will be coming up next week. So it's a three-parter, but it's worth it. It's so good. So enjoy.
The writing part was amazing too, because again, you know, as I said, I wrote for a hobby, so I would write sketches. I started writing a bunch of sketches for InterVarsity to perform. I was writing sketches for for the school itself, just for fun. We would do a show every year where the dramaturgs, the theater critics, criticism and dramaturg students, and the management students, the non-artist students, put on a show for the directors and the playwrights. I was writing for that show. I started working on a novel for fun, and within that, I'm personal assistant to Howard Stein. I'm learning amazing things at this program. My favorite semester was when we had two directing classes back to back and two criticism classes back to back. The directing classes, one was being taught by a Broadway director, and the other class was being taught by a fringe indie.
Oh, wow.
The criticism classes, one class was being taught by the head critic for the New York Times, the other for the Village Voice, which was the alternative paper. So four different quadrants, you couldn't get further apart.
Yeah.
They would all, the two would leave their class, go to get a cup of coffee before heading home. The other professors before their class would be getting a cup of coffee to prep them for the class. So all four would be right around our coffee machine. And I took my break every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at that time, and I would just sit out there. Because invariably, one of them would say, hey, did you see such and such a show? And off they would go. Four completely different opinions, wrestling with each other, very respectful of each other. And I learned so much. And at one point, too, which again plays into God knowing where I was going to end up, Howard took me into his office. And I got to type up all of his, every time he wrote a paper, I got to type it up for him. So I'm learning a lot already about writing. I'm sitting in on all the playwriting and directing classes, because that was one of the requirements at Columbia at the time, is that the managers could not just take management classes. They also had to take some art classes. I'm still not thinking of myself as a writer. When Howard asked me, is there anything that this program is not giving you? And I was like, well, I'll be honest with you. If I watch a play, I know if it's any good. It's easy for me to watch a play and go, yeah, that's not a good play. I don't know how to read a script and know whether that's going to become a good play.
Yeah, right.
I've been trained to be a producer, and I don't want to spend $5 million on a play to find out that the play, you know, stunk the whole time. And so he said, okay. So what we did is we had an independent study for a year with him. Every week he would give me five plays to read. And I would read the plays, and then on Friday I'd have to go into his office and discuss the plays.
Wow.
And famous plays, they were bad plays, they were good plays. One of the five every week was typewritten without a cover page. So I didn't know, was it written by Arthur Miller or was it written by one of his students who flunked out?
I don't know. Yeah.
Could never bake, you know, and he made that important. It's like you can never judge a play based on who wrote it. You have to judge a play on its own.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was it was basically a year-long master class with the master.
For sure.
Driving me to understanding what I teach now. This is, you know, so much of what has separated me as a teacher comes directly from sitting at Howard's feet and studying plays when I did not think I was going to be a writer.
Yeah.
So it's all of this coming at. Do you have time for another story?
Oh, yeah. And look, if we go too long, okay. We'll just divide it over two.
Okay. Or feel free to edit anything that you want out. My feelings will not be hurt. So another thing that happened there, when I was in undergrad, my Christianity, I was in the theater department. There was only two other active Christians in the theater department. It was very lovely because I was surrounded by people who loved me, who didn't agree necessarily with my Christian thing. Our sexual lifestyles, very different. Sexual preferences, very different. To this day, I can tell you what weed smells like. I've never smoked But I'm very, very familiar with it because I've been to many, many parties where that was very strong. But they really embraced me. There's a group of seniors my freshman year who saw how young and naive I was, because I was incredibly naive, who just completely embraced me, protected me. I was in an environment where I was never, ever pressured to do anything I was uncomfortable with. Because it wasn't an environment of judgment. It was an environment of, we love each other. We want the best for each other. And if Gaffney doesn't want a drink, you don't force him to do that. That's not healthy to force anybody to do anything they don't want to do, that they're not comfortable with. So it was a great environment just for opening my eyes to, because of that, I could never become as stodgy in my faith as I wanted to be, because I always understood that this was the kind of place where Jesus was. You know, these are the kind of people that Jesus was around. And so it helped me a lot in that ways. However, on the other side of it, one of the bad habits I kind of picked up with it was starting to feel like, well, faith is just a personal thing. It's just a personal choice. It doesn't really... So by the time I got to Columbia, people didn't know I was a Christian at all. And I was like, that's just fine. Because it's not really, you know, it wasn't a hotbed of, you know, it's where all the conservative Christians go. It was more of a, no, this is, one example of that is our chapel, St. Paul's Chapel on campus. It said, "For the Church of God" above it. It was carved into the stone. And while I was there, there was a student movement to get that sandblasted off and instead say, "To the glory of man."
Ooh.
Because it offended some people that they had to walk by a building for those people,
yeah,
you know, for those Christian people. So that was the environment I was in. But I started to get involved in InterVarsity, which is a mistake. If you want to be a Lone Ranger Christian, don't get involved in InterVarsity. And my faith became more and more about, you know, it became integrated into who I was in a very positive and healthy way. But I knew that meant that I was going to be outed before long.
Yes.
You know, skipping lunches to go to prayer meetings. It was during the first Gulf War. There was a group of Christians and a group of Jewish people who would gather every night for a vigil to pray for peace, pray for safety, for the people involved in the war. So I knew that, you know, it was becoming more and more obvious. And the day did come where Howard was Jewish. Howard was very clear that Jew and Christian are not the same. not get along. He invited me into his office one day. So I was sitting across the desk from him. And he said, "Sean, I'm noticing that you're getting more and more involved in this intramural varsity thing," whatever, you know. And I was like, "Yeah." And he says, so are you a Christian? And I said, you know, being the strong, bold Christian, I said, "Well, yeah, I guess I am." and he started to get really, really animated with me. And he's like, no, that's not what I'm asking. I'm asking, do you actually believe that stuff?
Yeah.
I'm like, it's now or never, right?
Yeah.
So I said, "Yes, I do." And he just about came over his desk at me.
Oh.
He said, "Sean, you have to understand. Faith and art do the same thing. They ask the same questions. Who are we? Where did we come from? And where are we going to?" He said, "I believe the reason there is no great art being made in America today is because we have separated our faith from our art." He said, "It is your obligation as an artist of faith to combine your faith and your art."
Oh, wow.
Not quite what I was expecting.
No.
But he would point to his favorite writers. They were often lapsed Catholics. There were people who were struggling with their faith. They were struggling with existence. They were struggling with why, what are we doing here? And he was insistent. He was like, if we're not asking the big questions, the same questions that faith asks, not necessarily answers, but asks, why are we here? Why are we bothering? We're just passing time, as opposed to changing our society. You know, so things like Angels in America, he's sending me clippings when that came out. It's like, here's a Mormon, this guy's a Mormon and he's writing plays. You gotta, he sent me to, we had a sister relationship. Columbia University has a sister relationship with Union Theological Seminary, which has a lot of negative distinctions in certain circles, but it's where Bonhoeffer went, so I'm fine with it. Yeah. But it's there was a professor there who was a Shakespeare scholar, and he said, you have to take a class with him before he retires. The only class he was teaching was Christology. So I have a Christology class on my Columbia University degree. He prompted me, he encouraged me. My master's thesis from Columbia is called Approaching the Arts, A Biblical Perspective. Mm-hmm. It was all about combining faith and art. So like I said, it's like secular, yeah. A huge part of how I approach my faith. Huge step, absolutely.
Yeah.
So then I went into producing. I'll try to be briefer here. Went into producing, worked for a company off Broadway, kind of ran through the ranks. That company closed, did some producing for free and off Broadway. the kind of producing where you're losing money because you're paying for the programs, sure. Kind of a thing. And got a job offer. I was actually working, my day job was as a church receptionist. I was answering the phone for Redeemer Presbyterian Church. And a job opened up being a managing director for a theater company in Seattle for Taproot Theater, which I was very reluctant to go. I've already taken up way too much time, but on another podcast, you'll have to ask me how God tricked me into going there. I went very reluctantly. For all kinds of pride reasons, all kinds of comfort reasons. The idea that I was going to leave New York City to do theater in another part of the country.
Yeah.
Who would do that? But it was a fantastic decision. Went there to run a theater company. I was the managing director. Worked for an artistic director who we just became really close, fast friends. Was really able to get behind his vision. Met the associate artistic director. I mean, these are people who I love to this day. Some of my closest. They're the family friends that you cannot see for 2 years, and it takes 5 minutes to just fall right back into the same level of intimacy that you had way back when. And I met Catherine twice there. Catherine Gaffney.
I was wondering where she would pop up in this whole story.
Up, yeah. She so the sappy story, and please cut this from your podcast.
No.
The sappy part of it, while I had sent my resume in, again reluctant, and thinking, I have an MFA, so I'm back to my I'm hot stuff, who wouldn't want me mode. And they never responded. So I called to find out, why didn't you respond to my resume? I'm hot stuff. Don't you know that? And the person who answered the phone said, well, Scott Nolte's not available, but I can tell you that he did a little happy dance when the resume arrived. So, Scott and I had already had we were seeking each other out before this in different ways. So I was like, okay, so he was happy. So I thought, well, as long as I have you on the phone, let me ask questions about Seattle. What's the life like? What's the theater scene life like? Get some more details that I couldn't get from the things I've read about the theater. Kind of get an insight. What's the culture like? And I must have talked for that person for an hour and a half, 2 hours, which is really bad because I was on my lunch break, which could only have been half an hour. We talked forever, and I hung up the phone and called a friend of mine and said, well, I think I have to move to Seattle just so I could marry that person. She's like, great, great voice. I got there and I had to tell God, I'm like, I was kidding. It was a joke. You didn't have to. Didn't have to make that happen, but it happened. And Taproot is also where I started writing professionally. There's a play that fell through that we needed for touring. So I went home and wrote it. They did not know I was a writer. So I went home and wrote a play that fit what we were looking for. Handed it to my boss on Monday, said, hey, a friend of mine wrote this. Does this help us? He said, yes, it's like he was reading my mind. This is exactly what we need. Would your friend be willing to give us the rights? And I had to admit, well, I'm that guy.
I actually
long playwriting. So I became a playwright. Started to phase out of that job to be writing more full time. VeggieTales had just come out.
Mm-hmm.
Like most adults, I loved it. At that time, I didn't know any kids who were watching it. It was all people of college age and up.
Yeah.
That were watching. I had a friend of mine. We were talking about VeggieTales, and he said, "Too bad they're so limited because they're so funny." And I said, "What do you mean limited?" And he said, "Well, they're telling Bible stories, and there's so many Bible stories you can't tell for children." And I said, "Okay, well, like what?" Because I couldn't imagine or you couldn't tell for children. And he said, "Well, like David and Bathsheba, you could never tell that story for children." So I took that as a dare and wrote a story about a king who collects bath duckies. Because part of the dare was we had to include the scene where David sees Bathsheba taking her bath.
Yeah.
So I've got the king who collects bath duckies who looks over and sees this little kid who has one bath ducky and ends up sending off to the pie war so that he could steal his bath ducky, and then Nathan the prophet comes and uses flannel graph to tell him how he did wrong.
Ooh, flannel graph.
Yeah. So I wrote a VeggieTales episode.
Fantastic. Everyone should watch King George and the Ducky, really. It's important.
And it's better than I wrote, because what happened with it, I wasn't intending to sell it, and VeggieTales was not taking outside writers.
Sure.
They weren't even looking at them. So for me, it was just for fun. It was just to kind of prove I could do it. I had another friend who worked for Microsoft. His wife is actually one of the key things that helped me get introduced to Taproot to begin with. His wife was one of two people. We had two people at our wedding who knew both of us, had worked with both of us independent long before we met each other. Mm. And she was one of the two. Well, her husband was an animator who was being wooed by Big Idea. And for his interview, he was at the part of the interview where they flew him in, showed him houses, and said, "Well, what else can we do for you?" He said, "Would you read my friend's script?" And handed them my script.
Fantastic.
They ended up buying it. Phil Vischer completely rewrote me, like a massive rewrite. Which is a very good thing, because by comparison, my script is nowhere near as good as that final product. It's great. I get story by credit for it, and it's great that I get to take credit for it, but it's really because Phil Vischer saved me. But it launched me into writing animation, started launching me into the idea of writing for TV. I took a program, Act One Writing for Hollywood, in L.A., which was training Christians to be writers in Hollywood. From that, my wife and I felt like God was calling us to L.A., moved to L.A., continued to do some work with Big Idea, wrote some books, started to do some more teaching, ended up getting – I had a mentor, Dean Battali, who told me that I needed to get a job on a lot because I needed to see how the business of Hollywood works so I could understand. It's not enough just to be a good writer. You have to understand the business side of it.
Mm.
So I ended up getting a job at Warner Brothers, started temping there, and then in their story department, which is the library for the Warner Brothers features. So every script that they're looking at, that they're considering, goes through the story department. Mm. It's being developed, continues through the story department. So it was, for a writer, it was a dream place to be. It was purely administrative. There was no creative. I had no input onto the quality of what was being done. But I was there for most of Harry Potter. I was there for the Chris Nolan Batman series. I was there at a really kind of a golden age, what Warner's was doing. And I got to learn great things. I didn't get to teach much while I was there. I could do church drama conferences, weekend things. But because of my schedule, I couldn't do a lot of adjunct work, and missing teaching. You're getting my whole life story. This is a whole lot more than you have.
It's fantastic. You tell a good story, Sean.
So we had, there's a member of our community, named Jack, who, he was just an amazing writing professor, amazing writing teacher. He taught with Act One. He ran the Warner Brothers television writing program for many years. So a lot of the was taught in Chicago, taught overseas, taught at any university that needed somebody to come in. So he's teaching at Christian universities, teaching at secular universities, just a fantastic, fantastic man, and a stronger man of God you'd have trouble finding.
Mm.
He passed away suddenly, kind of a surprise. He was in great health, but it apparently was his time. He was the kind of guy that, you know, he had to have several memorial services because there wasn't space enough for everybody to say what they needed to say.
Mm-hmm.
At his funeral, they had a slideshow where they were just running quickly the titles of television shows and movies of his former students. And that, you know, by the time they hit 70, they stopped because they just didn't have enough time.
Yeah.
to describe the influence he had. There were writers. There was one writer who's well known in LA, a very successful TV comedy writer. He says, "I don't believe in God. I'm not part of you Jesus freaks." however, I will tell you that trying to understand you guys. I tried to understand who Jesus was, and I realized if every time anybody told a story about Jesus, if I pictured Jack Gilbert, I would understand what you were talking about.
Oh, my goodness. Is that not just how we want to be? Like, that's the plan.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. But he left a huge hole.
Yeah.
And I remember after one of the, because I attended every memorial service I could, even if it was just to listen to other people's stories, I'm going to tear up now.
Mm.
But I have his friends of his gave me a poster that hung in his house of Oscar-winning films, so I have a piece of him with me.
Mm.
I remember we were talking, and we said, we can't find another Jack Gilbert. It's going to take all of us to fill what he's leaving behind. So we all kind of made this commitment that we would all, in some way, if we could find a way to step in and fill the gap, we would. And that's when the teaching kind of came back.
Yeah.
There was an opportunity for a school to maybe teach the course that Jack taught, just kind of a one-off thing, which turned into a possibility of maybe doing full-time instead. And every step of the way, Catherine and I felt like God was saying, yep, that's what I want you to do. That's what I want you to do. And so it ended up also being convicted. My friend Bob said, he was talking to me just about, you know, he's like, oh, you've got a nice gig at Warner Brothers. It's a nice, sexy gig, right? Warner Brothers?
Yeah.
Like, if you want to come have lunch with me, we'll have lunch on the Warner Brothers lot. Maybe maybe we'll be sitting near the Big Bang Theory cast. Who knows? You know, who knows who you're going to run into? It's a very kind of a sexy thing. But he was reminding me that, you know, what he said is he said, when I was thinking about making this decision and leaning not to going into full-time teaching, he said, Warner Brothers, great job, isn't it? I'm like, yeah. And he said, 'cause it's safe.
Oh.
ouch. Oh, kidney punch. Yeah, it was safe.
Yeah.
I had a nice salary. I had health benefits. I had a job that looked sexy on paper. I didn't have any artistic input.
Yeah.
But I didn't have to have any because it was safe.
Yeah.
And the whole reason I took the job was to learn the business, and I had learned all I was going to having spent 9 years in the system, right? So he was dead on right. We had good people in our lives who was able to speak truth in love.
Mm.
So that made a full-time jump. So Catherine and I moved to the East Coast, took a job with a university. They were trying to change the direction of their program as a Christian university. Had a president who just aligned with me. I knew that when I disagreed with him, I'd always respect him.
Mm-hmm.
The way he was doing his decisions. There for a couple months, and they fired the president.
Oh.
And I know you work uni. And
yes.
Because so you kind of know the politics.
Oh, yes.
A different regime kind of stepped in, and then a regime behind that stepped in, and they really went in exact opposite direction of everything that I think the kingdom wants us to do.
Mm.
in extreme ways. I mean, it wasn't just, this is an uncomfortable place. It was a use Jesus's name to get students to come in and not giving them the quality that Jesus expects of his people, not preparing them for they wanted to become a diploma mill. That's their dream, is they want to be able to brag about how many students they thrust through their system. It grew, while I was there, the university grew four times the size. Wow. I was there for only 3 years. They grew four times the size, and they would brag that they decreased the number of professors during that time. Oh. So more professors than they had when they were a quarter of their size, and they were very proud of it. That was the direction they wanted to go in. So it was very difficult, and this is part of the this is a hard part of the story and journey for Catherine and I, because it was hard for me. My showing of the fruits of the Spirit was tested daily. And I lost. I did not pass. I did not come out of that. I did not come out of the lion's den, if you want to call it the lion's den. I did not come out of Nineveh with a stronger love. I did not. I failed this test, as it were. I allowed who I was to be controlled by the fight. That's one hard part is admitting the weakness of my own faith in that testing. One thing that makes it even harder is, you know, because people will ask us, it's like, aren't you sorry you guys made the mistake of making that move? And it wasn't a mistake. God wanted us to go there. For whatever reason, you know, part of the reason Catherine got her MFA there.
Yeah.
So for Catherine's life, it was a great move. So maybe that's why I was there. There were individual students that I got to work with that were great. Certainly the faculty I got to work with were great. There's no doubt whatsoever in our minds that God wanted us there, and he wanted us there while we were there, and we left when God wanted us to leave. Because God doesn't say, I'm going to put you in places where it's comfy and cozy all the time, right? No. God need people who want to sit on the couch and surf all day, right?
If you were safe, you know, if you wanted to be safe, you would have stayed at Warner Brothers. It's
exactly, it was very difficult. It was very challenging. I lost. That the only regret I have is that I allowed them in my head, which is something that I'm a big Harry Potter fan.
Yeah.
At one point I felt like, I should be rereading, going through the Harry Potter book. So I did it by tape, Jim Dale. If you haven't listened to the Harry Potter books, if you're a Harry Potter fan and you haven't listened to Jim Dale, do it. It gives you a whole nother approach to the books.
Okay. See, I'm a fan of the Stephen Fry books, but
Okay, there you go. There's the two, and I haven't done the Stephen Fry yet.
Okay,
so that's right. That's my next thing.
Sure.
So you'll recall there is the entire time when Voldemort is getting into Harry's head, and he needs to practice how to prevent that from happening, and his anger keeps getting in the way. His dislike of Snape keeps getting in the way. His pride keeps getting in the way. He has all of these excuses for why it's okay that he is not learning occlumency. I don't know if I'm right, but I'm out there jogging, because at that time I was actually exercising on a regular basis. Out there jogging, listening to this, just going, oh, God, do you have to be so obvious? It's like, because that is exactly what I was doing. I was allowing my pride, my sense of justice, my sense of what is right, and I don't disagree. I was not wrong in any of that. But was my pride tempered with humility, Was my sense of justice tempered with mercy?
Mm.
Was my sense of what is right tempered with love? Not so much. Not so much. And as a result, Voldemort was in my head. He had free access.
Yeah.
I would have, you know, I would have nonstop arguments with people who weren't there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who didn't care?
Yeah.
You know, there's no way you're going to win that argument because they're not even there. They're not thinking about you. They don't care whether they're right or not. They know they're not right.
Yeah.
They know what they're doing. So that was a tough lesson for me to learn about how weak I was in that situation. And I had to recover for a year after that.
Yeah.
And then Asbury came up. And Asbury, it's night and day as far as administrative approach to things. Asbury is the first place, I will say this, it's the first place I've worked at in a long time, because Hollywood, much like this last school that I had worked at, they're run almost exclusively by fear.
Mm.
Fear controls every decision. We're afraid that we're going to close like so many other Christian schools have closed.
Mm.
So let's do this.
Mm.
Well, is that really the most Christ-like thing you could do? Well, is it more important, Sean, that we do something that you feel is Christ-like, or more important that we stay open? Because we can't do Christ's work if we don't stay open.
Yeah.
So let's not do things the way Christ would do them so that we can stay, so that we can tell people that we're doing Christ's mission.
It's so easy to fall into that, isn't it?
So easy. So easy. We do it all the time to ourselves. And I remember here having a conversation with the president during my interview, and she said, she was saying that it's important, you know, God has told them to do certain things. For example, they want to be a small school. They want to stay a small school. They said, we feel that God wants us to do that. Does that mean that, will that result someday in us having to close? Because maybe. God didn't say that Asbury is going to last forever.
Yeah.
God didn't say that Asbury was the key to his kingdom. God, Asbury's here to serve God for as long as God needs it. So if we do what God tells us to do and it fails, we then have to rejoice that in that failure because we know that God is doing something with it.
Yeah.
And to hear somebody in administration have a view and I'm the most important thing for God. If I don't succeed, God can't succeed.
Mm.
Well, that hasn't been true of anybody.
Mm.
Jesus was the one and only person since Adam, you know, that God has been reliant on.
Yeah.
Because they screw up. All of them. Peter did. Paul did. You know, even after his conversion, Paul screwed up.
Yeah,
and the kingdom didn't crumble because it. The kingdom actually was strengthened if they had the humility to understand the mistakes that they made and to understand that it's not them. I have switched careers enough in my life to finally start to realize that God's plan is bigger than any piece of it.
Mm.
And you know, I got in trouble at the last place I worked because at one point, you know, I was asked point blank rhetorically, and I had a habit of answering rhetorical questions. But they said, you know, yes, maybe they were acknowledging that they did something, that what they did, the way they did it was wrong. They said, sure, what we did, if you look in the small view, what we did was wrong. But in the big picture, isn't it more important that the university stays open? And we were talking specifically about mission. And I said, well, if we're changing our mission, if we're not doing our mission, then no. It's not important that it stay open. If this script I'm working on do I need to do everything for every script to make the script work? No, that's my ego talking. That's me saying my work is more important than the kingdom.
So I thought that was impressive how everything wasn't always on the up and up, but Sean could see that God was there in the fear and in the failure and in the very difficult times. And even when Sean was unfaithful, God was faithful. It's good to remember that. I want to thank Catherine Joy from Joy Music House for the music. And if you think this talk would be helpful to somebody else, please share it with them or rate this on iTunes so that more people get to join in on these amazing conversations. And I will chat to you next week.